The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 5th of May, 2020. On the podcast today, Paul Griffiths, CEO of Predator Oil & Gas, discusses some of the highlights from their final results and outlines some milestones to come. Also on the podcast, Vadim Alexander, Head of Healthcare at SP Angel, discusses skin biotherapeutics. And also Glenn Goodman, former ITV business news correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, talks about Bitcoin, blockchain, gold and cryptocurrency news. And as always, I have two lists for you: top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs too. You can see both these lists, in fact top 10 versions of these lists, at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you can also check out our COVID-19 index. Yes, I'm not going to tell you anything about it. Have a guess if you don't know what it's about, but worth checking out. And it involves 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 28 companies. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Griffiths, Chief Executive Officer of Predator Oil & Gas. PRD is a ticker there. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Hello, Justin. I hope you're safe and well in these very, very, very difficult circumstances.
Yeah, well, I've been saying I work from home anyway, pretty much in an office, so yeah. I've been self-isolating before the term was popular. I didn't know I was doing it, but so it's a less of a transition for me, but I understand it is for a lot of people. But, you know, business carries on in a sort of, as it can, you know. You've released your annual report for the year ended the 31st December. Of course, it's historical, but it's a lot of good things in there. You've achieved a lot over the last 12 months, so we'll dig into that. Before we do, as always, Paul, if someone's listening, never heard of Predator Oil & Gas, can you just explain the parts of the business, please?
Okay, so Predator is focused on sourcing, appraising, developing energy resources that fit our 2018 IPO strategy of contributing to reducing CO2 emissions. And that's by focusing on markets and geographic regions where the level of CO2 emissions from carbon-intensive fuels is considered to be, let's say, an inappropriate level. And those countries at present are Ireland, Morocco, and Trinidad. Mm-hmm. I think the important takeaway from that is we are actually executing the strategy right now and have been since beginning of the year and late last year. So that's very important. Most companies make comments on this kind of strategy, but very, very few of our size are actually executing it.
Yeah. And I was just saying this then, at the moment, you know, there's many, many companies, you know, ironically, I think pre-revenue or startup companies are used to having no revenue because that's how they start. They're bootstrapped, they're lean, and the bigger companies, you know, the bigger companies that have lots of revenue and generating profits, they're suffering at the moment more, I feel, because, of course, they've got debt, they've got commitments in some way, and you are sort of used to running a lean machine, aren't you, really?
We always set this up as running a lean machine with as little capital as possible. And there will come times when you need more capital. And thank God, we, you know, we raised money at the beginning of the year before coronavirus. I mean, that's put us in an immensely strong position. But, you know, we've always chosen our projects carefully, as I'll talk about in a second, and that those projects fit very clearly two strategies. One, they have to be economic, very low commodity prices, with very low operating costs, high potential deliverability from wells. And two, they must be applicable to the new standards of global climate change and global climate change concerns. Because coming out of coronavirus, it is those companies that can actually demonstrate that they're doing something practical that are going to be favoured in the investment community.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's dig into these final. We'll go through the published results, and then we'll break it down into different geographic areas. So first of all, just take us through the accounts there, Paul, if you could.
Okay, so the accounts are on the website and are published in RNS today. And these are results for 2019. We had potentially up to the end of June to get them out under the LSE, FCA relaxation of rules to give 2 months grace. But we were prepared and ready to get these accounts out, and we wanted to put them out today to demonstrate the fact that, you know, there's a positive message for us during the coronavirus emergency, that we're in a position to survive and flourish during that emergency and come out of it exceptionally strong. So I think, you know, that message, to reiterate, concentrates on a number of things. One, that we put in place COVID-19 mitigation strategy that maintains our business growth during this very, very difficult time. We have the potential, because our projects were already carefully chosen to be robust, even at such exceptional circumstances, unforeseen as these. And we're still on track to deliver at low commodity prices, which makes us very, very competitive, by targeting local energy markets, having negotiated favorable commercial and fiscal terms, having reduced our capital requirements, having as ruthlessly as possible reduced operational costs wherever prudent to do so, and to focus on the key subject going forward, which is reducing CO2 emissions. There's no doubt that that is going to be the key focus of investment in the energy sector going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, let's look into the different areas then. Start with Trinidad. What's happening there, Paul?
So Trinidad, we've very pleased with the technical progress to date, which is, to be fair to say, exceeded our pre-injection expectations, pre-CO2 injection expectations, because this was the first time anybody had tried a project like this in Trinidad. So there was quite a lot of risk involved in actually getting the project off the ground, getting CO2 injected, and seeing what potentially would happen in the reservoir. I think it's also important to say that the data we've collected already allows us to optimize the CO2 injection volumes and to keep those costs as low as possible whilst creating the conditions and the confidence to increase injection volumes to maximize potential ore rates. Now, that was always the intention, but this is even more important now because at low oil prices, we need to get the maximum delivery per well. And, you know, that requires a little bit of patience to get to that stage, but it's very important at a time like this of low oil prices. We also are managing the HSE process because obviously Trinidad has been impacted by COVID-19, and that means we're preparing our site at present to receive large volumes of CO2, which involves slightly different working practices due to social distancing, but that's all being put in place to allow operations to continue throughout this crisis period. And I guess it will be very difficult to be smug in a situation like this, and we're not smug, we're just professional. We did, at the start, before coronavirus hit, and before we had any inkling whatsoever that it would hit, we put in a remote data gathering system at the site in Trinidad, at Innis Trinity, that allows us to look at all the data in real time every few minutes as to what's happening in the reservoir, which is very, very important when there's no air travel between UK, for example, and Trinidad. So it gives us ability to remotely control the data and control the operations without having physically to be present in the field. And we have qualified people, very good people, who implement our instructions. So that's very important too at a time like this, to maintain operations, again, at a low operating cost. Lastly, I'd probably say on this that the project economics were always robust and are robust at $20 a barrel West Texas. West Texas futures indicate maybe $32 to $33 a barrel by June 2021. So we have to face reality, all of us, that we are dealing with a low price commodity regime for the pretty much near future and maybe even the medium term. So your economics have to be robust under those circumstances, and ours are. And lastly, a situation like this allows us to give more thought to what value can be created out of CO2 sequestration, because we're actually sequestrating man-made CO2, not natural CO2. Like the United States, 70% of the CO2 is natural and can't attract carbon credits. So that's quite important to see how we can get a value out of that going forward in the future. So we'll give an operations update on Trinidad shortly, but everything's progressing on track, And patience is a great virtue at a time like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's move over to Morocco. Take us through what's happening there, Paul.
Okay, so Morocco, we remain drill ready. The rig is stacked at present in Morocco for our use at no cost to the company. All the approvals are in place. Well design has been carried out. Drilling program is being prepared. So we are ready to commence further well planning on operations and execute those operations the minute we get some relief on restrictions on travel. Obviously, you know, a rig crew, it's a Canadian rig crew, so they have to move into Morocco. Specialist services have to, personnel have to be brought into Morocco. And they can only do this if they can safely transit across international frontiers. So that's the thing, completely out of our control, that controls the timing on this. But rest assured, we are drill ready, and Morocco remains a fundamental plank in our business. Mm-hmm. What I would say there also is that Moroccan gas prices are tied to Brent oil prices. So Brent futures, I think, are tracking around about $35 about by June 2021 again. We're using that downtime, enforced downtime, if you like, in terms of the fact we can't get out there and stick a well down right now, to build the case for the gas market in Morocco. And that case is focused on, obviously, drilling success at Guercif, but also on developing compressed natural gas as a means of monetizing the gas very quickly. We're only 8 kilometers from Morocco's road and rail network that links Guercif to all the big industrial centers in Morocco. The current gas market, industrial gas market, is around about 40 million cubic feet a day. And that would be replacing imported fuel oil, which is very, very, very carbon intensive and very much more more expensive than gas. The electricity market is about 100 million a day and would replace imported, more expensive Algerian gas. And there is a market for vehicles to use CNG in Morocco, which is more less carbon intensive and cheaper than diesel. And the market size there is potentially huge. 3 million private cars being estimated in Morocco and 140,000 diesel burning vehicles. Even if we can just get 10% of that diesel market with CNG, that's about 70 million cubic feet a day gas to be delivered. So the opportunities to develop gas in Morocco remain robust. The price remains robust by comparison with Europe. And the low drilling costs we have, the approvals already in place, the rig availability, complemented with a clear pathway to monetization, which is achievable, and an understanding of the gas market, gives us an opportunity in this downtime to attract partners to look at the development costs and potentially invest in the development in a success case so we can move quickly.
Yeah. Okay. And any progress there in Ireland?
Well, normally I say Ireland is on the back burner, and you appreciate that there are regulatory issues, environmental issues. Well, actually, Ireland has exceeded our expectations. Maybe they were a bit conservative, but realistic. How to develop a gas business in Ireland to substitute for Ireland's carbon-intensive fuel, which allows it to have the status of one of the worst CO2 polluters in the European Union. So we're focused on a different business model now that we started developing towards the end of last year, which is offshore regasification of LNG using existing infrastructure. And I'm pleased to say that we've been discussing this opportunity with two particular parties. One is a global supplier of LNG, and it's important to say that that supply is not from shale gas. And secondly, a supplier of a regasification vessel suitable for maybe up to 150 to 300 million cubic feet of gas today to the Irish market. So we're pretty well advanced with those two entities as our preferred partners. So the offshore regasification vessel owner would supply the capital at no cost to no capital cost to ourselves to develop the link up to the export gas pipeline, the subsea export gas pipeline. And we've started the processing of engaging and informing the Irish regulatory authorities of our position in terms of this project and developing this project. And also, we are independently with the gas transmission network looking at the engineering of the network to accommodate this additional gas through the point of entry that we have chosen. Mm-hmm. So in probably 2 months, 3 months, we have progressed this from a piece of paper on a table to something where I think people will be pleasantly surprised that we are actually the leader in this process offshore Ireland for offshore regasification, and that we're seen as the instigator, promoter, and administrator of the project by the parties, these global parties that we are dealing with. Mm-hmm. And this fits entirely with EU policy on security and diversity of energy supply, which has been focused and is focused on LNG imports and developing gas to storage. So we're contributing potentially to the opportunity to reduce CO2 emissions in Ireland. It is not necessarily a project that's going to happen tomorrow or the next day, but we're far more advanced now with traction on the project, with the development of the project than we were 2 or 3 months ago. And we are pleasantly surprised that this has moved so quickly to this stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, lots going on there, Paul. So if you can, in summary, in bullet point form, if someone's listening right now, three reasons why they should add you to their watch list, please.
So three reasons. One, we're well capitalized, which is very important during coronavirus, and we have a clear COVID-19 risk mitigation strategy, which is laid out in our financial statements today, to allow our business to continue to grow. Secondly, our projects are robust economically at low commodity prices, which is going to be with us for some time yet. And we're focused on local markets hungry for alternative energy options to address the pressures of climate concern. And lastly, our objectives are achievable and affordable, and the business aspirations are achievable on that basis. They're funded by current cash resources. They're focused on becoming at least a carbon neutral energy company in the very near term. And that's not by 2050, when most senior executives will have retired by then. So ours is a near term carbon neutral strategy, not setting goals far in the future. And near term means a couple of years.
Excellent stuff, Paul. Good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your time, and it's a pleasure, and stay safe.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Vadim Alexandra, Head of Healthcare at SP Angel. Vadim, thanks for coming back on.
Thanks, Justin.
You're in a very interesting sector at the moment. Lots of things going on there. It's very exciting, especially with COVID-19 happening. Lots of companies pivoting to sort of fight that. But I said, you've got a lot of information in your head. You do a lot of research. And I said, let's try and get you on more regular. But last time you came on, we did lots of coverage, lots of companies. So let's try and do one company a week if we can. So this week, which company are you looking at?
Yeah, so this week, last week, we spoke a little bit about COVID and all the COVID-related companies. Mm-hmm. Today, I'm going to just stray a little bit away from that, although there is a COVID link potentially, but it's not quite in the same category as the ones we discussed last week. But just to give everyone a breath of fresh air and to stop talking about COVID specifically for 1 week, I think we have a company in mind that I'll focus on. It's a Skin Biotherapeutics. It's a company that's in the area of the skin microbiome.
What does that mean?
The ticker is SBTX. We've spoken about this company in the past, but I'll just reiterate kind of what they do. They are in the area of, we've heard of the microbiome of the gut, which is a very hot area in terms of, for example, functional foods. Well, what they do is it's the same idea, but it's for the microbiome of the skin. So the natural flora of your skin protects your skin, and keeping it balanced is quite important. And a lot of cosmetics companies are very interested in this sector right now. It's it's as hot in cosmetics today as it was in foods only 2-3 years ago. So, you know, we all know about probiotics in yogurt, for example. That's still a very, very big area. Well, the same thing applies to cosmetics of the skin, and that's the area that skin biotherapeutics is in.
Yeah, and so skin health, and it's basically, and the skin, is it the largest organ of the body or something? Is that a fact? I'm sure it's a fact I've heard something.
I'm not sure if that's a fact. I think it might be. It may very well be. It certainly makes sense, but whether that's, I can confirm that or not, I don't know. But it certainly makes sense.
In fact, I just looked it up on Wikipedia. So the human skin is the outer covering of the body and is the largest organ of the integumentary system. So obviously,
okay, well, there you go.
Is it obviously
for the refinement?
Yeah, subsection of that. So okay, sorry. Off you go, Vadim.
It's certainly a very important organ because it does protect us. And here is the COVID angle, if you like. It does protect us from all invaders. It's probably the most important barrier to the outside world, for obvious reasons, mm-hmm. but it also for not so obvious reasons, and that's therein lies the microbiome. So, you know, a healthy microbiome of your skin keeps your skin in good shape, if you like, and protects you from further invaders, further pathogens specifically. So good bacteria on your skin protect you from bad bacteria on your skin. And that's the technology that they are leveraging. And that's the technology that interests cosmetics companies, because they're always looking for the next big thing. And quite frankly, that's what I believe. I believe that, cosmetics are changing. Are pushing in that direction and doing so very quickly. And I guess that's the main message today for skin biotherapeutics, is that, I do think this company, it's starting to be a bit less overlooked now. The share price has rallied quite significantly in the last couple of weeks. But alongside, the whole sector, the sector's done well as well. But most specifically is that I think it has further to run because of this element of the commercial element is happening right now with the company, but it hasn't fully been appreciated, I think, by the market, in that, they have a deal with a company called Croda, which is a FTSE 100 company. Mm-hmm. They are the manufacturer of most inputs to most large cosmetics companies. And they struck an agreement with Skin Biotherapeutics to have one of their ingredients as part of that, using their technology as part of, as part of that supply chain to the larger larger cosmetics companies. So it's a great agreement. It's an agreement with a multi-billion pound company. And they, they're quite serious. They're investing into the infrastructure that's required to produce this skin biotherapeutics ingredient, which is a multi-million pound commitment. So it's, I find that element of this story has been overlooked. The next phase of this business is the commercial phase. It's already started. It started with big players. And I think there's going to be a lot of news flow generated out of those. Not only that agreement, other subsequent agreements. They've signed another agreement with another company on another area. But the point being is that the commercial phase of the company of Skin Biotherapeutics has just commenced. And, I think the next 2 to 3 years are going to be all about commercial rollout. And that just the market hasn't quite caught on to that yet. Although I think more recently it's starting to catch on. This rally is the beginning of that, I think.
Yeah, and so what is it? Their product is one ingredient, or what is it? What is it, their product?
Yeah, so it's basically, I won't get too technical, but it's a set of lysates from bacteria. So basically bacteria have certain components within them, the good bacteria. Remember how we were talking about the biome is all, the microbiome is all about good bacteria have certain protecting features to the skin against bad bacteria, just like they do in the gut, okay? Mm-hmm. So their technology revolves around certain molecules that are from good bacteria. So they basically break up good bacteria, and they have an extract from that lysate, which is what it's called, which is what's included in or potentially included in cosmetic products. So it's that lysate that is their technology. Yeah. And that's all the, if you like, all of the components that are important, or at least that skin biotherapeutics think are important in protecting the skin from other potential pathogens and increasing the health of the skin as well. It does both.
Well, I can imagine why. Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense that skin should be a massive area, and I suppose it is already, isn't it? You know, all the cosmetics you can get, because, you know, if something goes wrong with your skin, then you've got some big problems. Yeah, I see this. They're focusing on cosmetics, infection control, and eczema as well. So that's the areas they're focusing on. And, but do you reckon this is the year they're building these commercial partnerships that could take them towards or closer towards cash generation? Because at the moment, they are loss-making, aren't they?
Well, yeah, so I guess that's worth mentioning as well, is that the company is in good financial position. For a company that's not that's still, you know, technically is in development phase, but already with partners now, which is the bit that's quite important, is they're fully in development now, moving towards, you know, commercialization of product, as in final stages of development of products with their partner Croda, and then commercialization of those products. But for a company in that position, they're not burning much cash. They have a healthy balance sheet. You know, I think the last balance sheet date, they had over 2 million sterling on their balance sheet. They're not burning enormous amounts of money per month, and they're signing partnerships where a lot of the costs are taken up by the partners. So, you know, Croda again is supporting them in terms of, you know, the manufacturing lines, etc. So it's they're in good shape financially for a company at their stage of development, if you like. They're in good financial position, good financial health, and they have good backers. You know, I think a couple of, maybe just over a year ago, one of their institutions, Seneca, you know, supported them on a fundraise. I know they're supportive, so.
Yeah. It's very engineered. Just looking at their website, of course, it says skincare market is worth $100 billion, a high growth area, and eczema alone is worth $3.6 billion. So that's
absolutely
big, commercial end markets there, aren't they?
These are enormous markets, and you know, so cosmetics is one area, and it's the nearest area. But in time, the company will evolve up the, if you like, the value chain, and you know, medical devices, because certain creams can be applied for in terms of medical devices. So that gives you a little bit more exclusivity on your products. And as you move up the value chain, you get up to pharma eventually. But the ultimate point is, you know, for the time being. Even cosmetics, well, even I say even, you just mentioned a $100 billion market, but you know, these are enormous markets. You know, there is cosmetics standalone is where the company is focused right now on commercial success, and they can get there very, very, I think, fairly quickly.
Yeah.
So you know, and like I said, there's all the upside of all the other sectors, medical devices, you know, and pharma, but. You know, that's for a future focus. Right now, there's a lot to go after strictly in cosmetics. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? It is. I've just looked up the answer. The skin is the largest organ of the body. In humans, it accounts for about 12 to 15% of total body weight and covers 1.5 to 2 meters square of surface area. So there we are. I knew I heard that in a quiz somewhere. What's the largest organ? Because everyone just assumes it's like the lungs or the heart, It's actually obviously the skin. It's all over us.
I've heard that all my life, Justin, as well. And thank you for confirming that for me, because I've never actually had it confirmed. So that's good to know.
I vaguely remembered it. So there we are. Marvelous stuff, Fadeen. Thanks for that, and we'll speak to you next week.
Perfect. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now, I saw him on TV, actually. I was on the treadmill. A nice little surprise. Early morning run, my treadmill run. I was watching Explained, which is a Netflix series, and he was talking about pandemics and all of that. No, it's talking about cryptocurrency, of course it was. Cryptocurrency. And Glenn Goodman's face popped up there. Where were you, Glenn, when that happened? What was that all about?
Well, that was long, long ago, Justin. That was 2008. I was at a City Brokers in Canary Wharf, and it was the day that Lehman Brothers collapsed. Yeah, exactly. I was doing a TV report for ITV News, who I was a reporter for at the time, and yeah, the whole world was falling apart, and so that clip that you're referring to gets wheeled out for quite a lot of documentaries, because it's got me basically saying nobody knows what terrible disaster will be round the corner next.
It's a pity you can't get repeat fees on things like that, isn't it? You know, kind of just you know, check your tenor for every time it's shown or something. You know, it'd be nice.
Yeah, well, ITN just they take all the money.
Do they get paid for that? Those little library clips, they get paid for that, I suppose, do they?
Or? Yeah, yeah. They've got a lucrative business in archive footage, because obviously ITN have got 50 years worth of archive footage from the news, as have the BBC. And yeah, loads of people license these clips all the time for TV programmes all over the world, not just in this country.
Yeah, well, do you know what? It's quite relevant. It was about cryptocurrency and why Bitcoin was created. And essentially, Bitcoin was created because, you know, normal money, the way we use, you know, Bank of England money, is based on trust, isn't it? It's based on the Bank of England, you know, us trusting them. And you could say, well, we don't really know what's going on with the Bank of England. Because, I mean, unless you're up on your finances, and then, you know, you probably know that they are printing money, and the Fed is as well, unbelievable amounts, which means that dilutes circulation pretty much. So the currency, it devalues it. Whereas with Bitcoin, it was invented because you didn't need trust. It was a peer-to-peer network where, basically, transactionally, you didn't need trust because everyone, you know, you'd have to, all people's ledgers would have to match up. Every you know, transaction would be verified by lots of different people. You didn't need to know who they were because basically it was multiple people verifying it. And that's why it was set up. And right now, did you see yesterday, the Fed, I was working out, the Fed borrowed pretty much $3 trillion in the first quarter. First time ever they've done that. It's five times more than they did in 2008, the financial crash. And I just worked it out. I said, well, how much is that then? Because trillion is, I know if you count a trillion in seconds, it takes you 31,000 years. But that is, I worked out, if you took a loan out for $3 trillion, you pay it back over 100 years, you have to pay $82 million a day for 100 years. And that's interest free. And theirs is not industry, of course. So that is a... It goes on paying back $82 million per day. That's nuts, isn't it?
I mean, the amount of money printing is obviously beyond anybody's comprehension now. But as you quite rightly point out, when Bitcoin was first invented, it was invented very explicitly with the goal of combating this kind of money printing in mind. In fact, in you may remember, and it's in my book, The Crypto Trade, they've got the we've got the first block that was ever invented, the so-called Genesis block, which is the first load of transactions in Bitcoin. So on right at the beginning in 2009, embedded in the code was a little message about how the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time, George Osborne, had bailed out the banks. So sort of, you know, deep within all the code, all the ones and zeros and so on, you've got this little message just standing on its own. And actually, you know, I have to say, in a perverse kind of way, it makes me feel proud to be British, because it kind of proves that we're still, you know, however much the papers and a lot of journalists now tell us we're nothing, we're nobody, and when we're outside the EU, we're going to be nothing and nobody will care about us. The fact is that Satoshi Nakamoto, making this universal currency, Bitcoin, inventing it out of scratch, he chose to talk in his Genesis block just about the Chancellor of the Exchequer and how he was printing money. Well, yeah, he wasn't. It was obviously the Bank of England, but that how the Chancellor had bailed out the banks. And yes, I say that kind of makes me feel like we're still significant in some way here in Britain, that we were pinpointed in that way. And I mean, okay, it was just an example, taking the Chancellor. He could have equally turned to America or the European Central Bank and looked at what
so
they were doing.
That's a clue, isn't it? I think that's a clue. But no one actually knows as to the identity of who. You know, what's his name? Sochi Nakamoto.
Yeah. So you're thinking he might be British?
Yeah, the
of
fact that he's more aligned to British, you know, sort of Bank of England than rather the Fed, because the Fed is the biggest, most powerful in the world, and everyone sort of looks towards that. But he must have been familiar with the British system if he'd said that, you know?
Yes, but I think that's the point, isn't it? That everybody who knows a lot about money is familiar with the British system, because it's still one of the most important ones in the world. We're a force to be reckoned with, Justin. We are not to be ignored. Do you understand?
No, I think we punch above our weight. but also, a lot of it is historical and legacy, because, you know, we were a massive sort of player back in the day.
Yeah, the pound was the global reserve currency until 130 years ago.
But not for a while. We haven't been, you know, with the sixth biggest economy in the world, and we're nothing compared to the, you know, it's America and China. So to say, I mean, to say that, I think it says something about the location of the inventor of Bitcoin.
Well, we punch a lot above our weight in financial terms, if nothing else.
Yeah, because it's a human. So anyway, looking at the Bitcoin price here, that's quite bullish, isn't it? That's breaking above the 200-day moving average and everything now. And even what we said a while back, do you remember what I said a while back? I said, listen, when you get just a very obvious sort of crossover, like the Golden Cross that happened a while back, we had the big dash for cash, of course. But it's almost reverted back to trend now. So like, you know, it's going. They've, like I said, that they crossed the 50-day and the 200 cross. In fact, it went back down and crossed back down again. But it's coming back up now. So, what are your thoughts? That's quite.
Well, at this time last week, I was saying that Bitcoin was sort of poised to do something.
It was poised to
possibly make a big move because it had reached a kind of an important resistance level. Basically, it had reached the level where it had fallen very heavily in March. And it had got all the way back up now to that same level where it started plummeting. So the point was, when you get to a point like that, generally, if it manages to just squeak above that level, then it can rock it, which is what I said might happen, though I was also equally expecting it to go the other way. But either way, when you're at an important point like that, you expect a big move one way or the other. And so I was ready for it, and I bought Bitcoin heavily as it broke out. As it started to rise very fast on the 29th of April. And so I made some good money there, but I decided when it reached a peak above $9,000 a few days ago, in fact, actually just a day after it started rising, I decided to sell it again. You'll notice there might be you may have noticed there's a pattern to my buying and selling recently. Traditionally I try and trade for the longer term, try and pick up the big trends that last for weeks or months or sometimes even years. But at the moment, I'm chickening out quite quickly, and I did it again. I sold, I took my profit off the table, which is nice. It's nice to bank your profit, but it means that I'm not in Bitcoin now, and the trend is still looking distinctly bullish at this particular moment. So there could well be another surge, and this time I might not catch it because I'm out of Bitcoin. So why did I sell? Why did I lose my nerve? Mainly because Bitcoin is still trading quite strongly in line with the stock market. It's aping what the stock market does. It fell when the stock market fell in March, and then it started rising, aping the stock market's rise ever since throughout the whole of April. And it's now even moving somewhat ahead. It's starting to accelerate with that big rise. The stock market didn't have a big rise like that on the 29th of April. So Bitcoin is kind of pulling ahead now. But even so, what worries me is that if Bitcoin is so heavily influenced by the movements of the stock market there at the moment, then if the stock market takes a big plunge, then Bitcoin could take a big plunge. And I don't have enough faith in the stock market because, as we've talked about 100 times, the world economy is in a terrible state and will probably continue to be in a terrible state for the foreseeable future. So it seems very risky to be heavily in the stock market right now. Yeah, the stock market could continue rising because we always know that markets defy reality. They can defy reality longer than you can stay solvent. Yet at the same time, there is always at a time like this, a massive risk that we'll just get a second massive leg downwards that will get, you know, say a 20% or 30% fall in the stock market. And I'm pretty certain that would drag Bitcoin down with it if it happened.
I'm staying out for risk management reasons.
I'm nervous for risk management. I want to protect my capital. That's my number one priority, is protecting the money I have, not taking wild gambles.
Yeah, do you know what? That's exactly where I am. And I feel this market is not cheap. It is not cheap considering as to what's around the corner, and it's been pumped up, like I said, by the Fed, really pumping money in. And sooner or later, and it may seem long, because we look at the markets every day, pretty much too much probably. It seems like it's taken a long time to reflect the real economy, this market. But it will do, I think, because, you know, next quarter, when you have lots of companies that are, you know, they will be reporting on no revenue, no profit, or very little, and they've got debt, they've got bills beyond what the government is supporting them with, then we'll see the valuations come down because, you know, they can't justify the value that they're at. And so I've taken small stakes in three big companies that I see as market leaders pretty much in their fields, and that's Auto Trader, Barrett Developments and Greggs, right? But I still don't think they're cheap at the moment. I think I've, you know, I'm prepared for them to fall further, but I don't know if they will. So I've taken a third of my intended initial stake, so I've got two-thirds left to invest in them. But I'm prepared for them to fall a lot further before I start buying some more, because I think I was expecting, you know, over the next couple of years, 3 years, to hold these companies for 3 years, an easy double. But from these levels, they're not going to double because, I expect them to go a lot lower. But,
Two of those companies, Barrett and Greggs, it's tricky, isn't it? Because you've taken small stakes, so, you know, that's a sensible thing to do, obviously, because we don't know. This is the problem, is that we don't know how people are going to react when lockdown starts to be lifted. We don't know whether they're going to still be cautious for quite a long time or whether they're going to return to their previous behavior and start buying and selling houses again with just the vigor that they did previously. And likewise with Greggs, you know, are people going to start going out again in the same numbers that they did before? Are they going to be happy to queue up behind people in Greggs and breathe in people's breath and all the rest of it? How quickly are people going to get back to normal, and thus how quickly are Greggs's profits going to get back to normal? It could be a matter of weeks and we all just start behaving like we did before, or the trauma of this whole thing could just weigh on people's minds and they, you know, you can just kind of imagine there's a possibility at least that people will, even when they're back at work, we'll just start sort of walking past the Greggs and go, yeah, no, I don't quite fancy going in there. Looks like there's quite a lot of human beings like crowded in there. I don't fancy that. I'm going to make my own sandwiches at home. You know, that's a possibility, but how likely is it? Who knows?
We know, right? And it's I've been astounded by how fast sentiment can change, and I know this by looking at the stock market. One day the world is falling in, the sky is falling in on us, it's imploding. Next day is a couple of days rally and everyone's, hey, it's all cool, it's all back to normal. And I just genuinely feel if we got some antivirals working, we got some, the figures are down on deaths completely, and the report, and social distance is in place in these shops and stuff, people will change their mind. It's surprising how fast people revert to normal, because if you remember after the 9/11 attacks, people said, oh, airlines are finished here, no one's going to fly again now. And all of a sudden, Michael, what's his name? Ryanair guy, Michael, I can't think of his name.
Michael Ryan.
Yeah. His name started just buying up lots of cheap assets.
Michael O'Leary
was the guy with the gun who shot
Hungerford.
Junction 14, M4. I always travel past that and go back to South Wales. So sentiment can change on the flip of a coin. And literally, the majority, there'd be some people who are worried, of course, but when you get a background of now we've got an antiviral, or now we're over a vaccine, definitely that's a way off yet. Figures are completely down. It's non-existent pretty much. And do you know what? It may be. We're starting to see immunity is happening. This may just die out. We may even be close to herd immunity. We don't really know. The figures are like, have you noticed how fast these figures die out? When we could be close to it. You never know. We don't know how many people have had it. And now we're showing you can get immunity from it. All of a sudden, if it comes out, it looks like we've got herd immunity here and we get no new cases. It'll flip back to, I mean, obviously it'll take a while to ramp back up with these industries, but so anything can happen. But I just think humans are very capricious. They can just flip on sentiment so quickly.
It's true, and if they see everybody else returning to normal,
exactly, and that's herd mentality, herd immunity, exactly. I've seen the rally in the stock market, and I know it's not all back to normal, but I'm almost convinced it is. It's almost like, oh, I'm bullish again now. We've had the big fall off. I mean, hang on a second. I know we're not back to normal. There's just the levels of unemployment's going to happen. The liquidations, administration's going to happen, and we're nowhere near seeing these figures yet. Because, like I said, we are a patient on life support at the moment. Once life support's pulled off, then we'll see how the patient is. But I mean, until then, we can't really make a judgment on, you know, valuations and stuff, because we don't know how bad the patient is. You know.
No, I'm looking at the Bitcoin chart now and I'm thinking, it's still looking very positive. We have to, I think we have to allow for the possibility that even if the stock market doesn't continue to rise, that Bitcoin could have decoupled from the stock market. Yeah. Yeah, and could actually be pulling away, because of course there's a separate story for Bitcoin separate to the stock market. Well, there are a couple of separate stories. First of all, there's the halving that we've talked about a lot, where supply is going to be constricted from later this month onwards. There will be less and less new Bitcoin created, and that's helping to sort of fuel the rise, encouraging people to buy it. But also there's the threat of negative interest rates, and you know, we referred earlier to the Bank of England.
Explain and, how that works, if you know anything about it, because I'm confused by that. I think, how can there be I know quite a few of the governments around the world now, their bonds are negative rate and yielding negative rates. How does that work?
So basically, Kenneth Rogoff, the a Harvard economist, has been pushing for negative interest rates for some years, and he's been writing about it again. Now he's really pushing for it. The idea would be that literally the main interest rates are negative. In other words, the government, when the government sells government bonds, yeah, and wants people to finance its debt, people will pay the US government for the privilege of owning its debt, mm-hmm, rather than the other way around. So normally, of course, the government pays you to lend it money. When you buy, you know, gilts in this country, or when you buy treasury bonds in the United States, you're effectively financing the debt of the US government, and you get paid interest for lending the government money. This flips it on its head and basically says, if you want to buy some of this government debt and lend the US government money, then you need to pay the US government for the privilege of lending it money.
And
why isn't it?
But what's the incentive for people to do that?
The incentive is, particularly for big institutions and pension funds and those kind of things, they have a regulatory mandate to own, to keep a lot of their money, a lot of their investment in safe investments. And US Treasury bonds, and to a slightly lesser extent, gilts in this country and bonds from the European Central Bank, they are considered safe investments, pretty much the safest form of investment. So pension funds are obligated to put quite a lot of their money into safe investments. So they're over a barrel, in other words. And even ordinary people buy treasury bonds because they want to keep some of their money in safe investments as well. Bear in mind, if you have a negative interest rate environment, as Kenneth Rogoff explains in his latest article, any large entity or company that wants to save money, that wants to keep cash, will be penalized for that under a negative interest rate environment. If they want to keep it in a bank account, they will have to pay interest to the bank for the privilege of putting their capital in that bank. But what Kenneth Rogoff does say is that the policy would have to not be extended to ordinary depositors, to small depositors like ourselves. We would somehow be insulated from that. That would have to be something that was put into place specially so that we didn't have negative interest rates. Maybe ours would be zero. So we just put our money in a savings account and just got zero interest. But the fear is, you see, that if small individual people, retail traders or investors like ourselves, if we were made to pay negative interest rates, then we'd just withdraw all our cash. There'd be runs on banks. We'd take out our money and we'd hide it under the bed. We'd bury it in our back garden as pound notes.
So what's what's the point? So basically, people wouldn't buy as few government debt as possible and they'd invest it. Is that the case in the stock market?
Yeah, I mean, that's why Bitcoin in particular and gold could benefit from this, because they're so-called hard currencies, the idea, you know, I guess that's why Kenneth Rogoff is so insistent that small investors like ourselves should not be penalized and not have to pay negative interest rates, because he knows that we'd all put our money into things like gold and Bitcoin because we
can. Who is he?
Kenneth Rogoff, he's a Harvard economist. He's a Harvard professor. Okay. So he's very well respected. He's written books about this kind of thing. Basically, this negative interest rates is a way for governments to penalize savers and to bail out lenders, creditors. You know, anybody who's got debt, it bails them out at the expense of sensible savers. It's a total nightmare from a monetary perspective. And for Kenneth Rogoff to be, he's so blasé about the whole thing. But, you know, that's how economists often are, isn't it? Is that they're just like, yes, we need to pull this big policy lever that's never been pulled before in the history of humanity. We've never gone to kind of that kind of degree of craziness. And yet, you know, he's a Harvard economist, so he thinks he knows what's going on. Frankly, I think there are enormous risks to that kind of monetary policy. It's terrifying. And yeah, it could push people into Bitcoin. Bitcoin could benefit if such a thing happens. But, you know, the reason, obviously, I haven't even said why they would do this, have I? The whole point of bringing in negative interest rates is to try and buoy up the economy, to force people to spend money, because keeping money in bank accounts would no longer be something that makes you any kind of interest at all. In fact, you may even pay for the privilege, and therefore you'll be much more willing to spend your money than to save it. That's the theory. The problem with Kenneth Rogoff and everybody else who says negative interest rates will buoy up the economy is that something kind of along those lines has been tried in Japan for the last 20 years, and it hasn't really worked out there. It didn't stop people saving. It didn't make them spend. In fact, if anything, some evidence seems to point to the possibility that it actually encouraged the Japanese to save more. Because they're getting nothing for their money, it actually made them scared and made a lot of people want to keep more money in the bank, even if they're not being paid interest for that privilege.
Yeah. It probably takes an economist, a deep thinker, to come up with that. But never, ever is anything as straightforward as the way people think. Things are always create bubbles elsewhere, don't they? When you push something down, something goes somewhere else. So it's never as straightforward as that, you know. But I've got his article up here, and I'm going to read it and with interest and see what he says, see if it makes any sense to me, see if I can actually understand what he's saying. But it's worth looking at. He's an article called The Case for Deeply Negative Interest Rates by Kenneth Rogoff.
Is that the one in Project Syndicate you're looking at?
Yeah, that's
the latest one that I was referring to there. Though, as I say, he's written books sort of talking about this kind of thing as well. But yeah, the article...
I couldn't go to a book on it. I could probably do an article.
The article's got everything you need. Don't bother with a book.
I know, a book is too much. I find investing... I've got a bit of levity in it. I find it very hard to read investing books, to be honest. I think the best thing to do is a bit of experience and then look it up on the internet. If you
understand. Except for the crypto trader. That was a really easy read, I found.
Lots of pictures.
When I picked up the crypto trader, I was like, oh, who's this smiling little fella on the front there? Yeah. And I got reading, and I just couldn't put it down, I tell you.
Well, it's odd you didn't recognise yourself as writing that book, really, because, you know, you thought, at least in the introduction, you cottoned on the fact that you've written it yourself.
I've got a short memory.
Yeah, that's very short. You're probably reading the first paragraph four times. I can't remember what I just said there. cool. Glenn, thanks
cool.
for that, fella.
And, cool, indeed.
Well, did you watch Saul? Call Saul. Did you ever watch that?
Better Call Saul. Well, with Saul Goodman. Yeah.
Saul Goodman. I didn't realise that was a... When I first Breaking Bad, he was a character in that. He's a spin-off, isn't he?
Yeah.
I've started watching his spin-off now. But I didn't realise it. And his name is Saul Goodman, you know? So, Saul Goodman. And I thought, that'd be a cracking name for you in the middle of your meeting there, Saul Goodman. So when you sign off, you just say, Saul Goodman, you know what I'm saying?
Shall I make videos like those ones he did in Breaking Bad, you know, the ones where he's advertising his legal services in a really tacky way on those cheap local TV adverts.
Yeah, it's quite slow. Have you watched any of it? It's quite slow, but I quite like it.
It's a slow burn. It's even slower than Breaking Bad, but it is. It's really, really good. It's really interesting. And obviously, I'm always, what's the word? When you support someone.
In your family, yes.
Well, I'm supporting the Goodman guy because he's got the same name. What do you call it? I've forgotten the word.
Nepotism.
No.
Nepotistic.
When you're kind of flying the flag for someone, when you're supporting them, when you're going, yay,
flying
go
the
on.
Flag, supporting them,
egging
yes.
him on.
Egging him on, flying the flag.
No,
yes.
I don't know.
We'll come back next week with the answer, yeah? Look it up.
Should we ask people to write in with what's the word Glenn's thinking of? You can win a special prize.
You can win one Bitcoin. No, in fact, you can't. You could have won it years ago, but it's too expensive now. Marvellous. Cheers, Glenn. Speak to you next week.
Okay, bye.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Mobile Streams, down 3.75% to 0.385. At four, Cinegen, down 9.15% at 64.5p. At three, Tizian Life Sciences, up 8.33% at 65p. At two, Motive Bio, which, I think it shot up by, I think 700% yesterday. It's now down 28% at 1.06p. And at one, it's GeneDrive, up 3% at 204p. All right, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, AsiaMet Resources, annual report and financial statements. At four, Zenith Energy, passing of resolution at AOGGM for tilapia. At three, Amiga Diagnostics, exercise of options and total voting rights. At two, Touchstone Exploration, framework agreement signed with NGC and Heritage. And at one, it's Argo Blockchain Mining, down 8% today at 5.1%. And that's the operation update for April. And there's also a bit of a director change. Timothy Ledrulnik is stepping down as chief financial officer. Okay, with immediate effect. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.